I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Steve Capra. He's executive director of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and Denise Foster is with us. She's Santa Fe director of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great. Thank you for having us.
Now, we're going to talk about wolves, and we're going to talk about the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and we're going to talk about a fabulous concert, benefit concert for the Alliance that's coming up. But let's, for a moment, just start with this. What is wilderness? It's actually a term that has a specific meaning.
Well, I think it's a term that is often confused by people. Wilderness is an act of Congress signed by the president. And so it's not anything to do with the state. It's not anything to do with the governor. And it's usually looking at an area of 5,000 acres or greater on public land, not private land, that is roadless. And it doesn't mean that the area has to be pristine. It doesn't mean that there was never a road there or never any trace of a human. It means that it has come back to a condition of wildness, and it is an area, as I say. And so when we look in our state, we see things like the Gila Wilderness, which was the first in the United States. Right here around Santa Fe, we have the Pecos. And so they're not to be confused with state parks or county parks, and it's not something that gets overturned. Wilderness is an act that lasts forever. That's why often our campaigns take so many years to evolve, because they're dependent on consensus, and they're dependent on getting our senators, our congressmen, and then ultimately the president to sign that act.
And so there are a number of wilderness areas in New Mexico, and they're roadless. Is there active wildlife conservation going on within wilderness areas?
Well, I think you have to look at them as islands of preservation. It's not that there's men are actually trying to manage it, so to speak. It is their pristine nature that draws wildlife to them quite often. And I think that's a really important aspect, especially when we're, you know, they're also becoming more or less laboratories these days as we have climate change affecting areas. They are the sort of area that has been left intact, and it's giving a lot of researchers areas to go and look at.
So let's talk now about wolves. We have been talking for years about wolves here in, well, on this program and with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance and with many others. And wolves were extinct or nearly extinct in New Mexico. How did that happen in the first place?
Well, wolves have a sort of a tragic history in our country, and it's something that's gone on for some time. You have to understand with Mexican wolves, between U.S. trappers and many in the ranching community, they were basically down to 7 wolves in the wild, only one of which was female, and all of which were in Mexico when they were captured and put in a captive breeding program. This has been something that's been ongoing for a long time, and now we finally have wolves back in the wild. You know, this is an effort that's been going on since 1998, and it's been an effort that has been fraught with frustration. And I think looking not only at what's happened here in New Mexico, but take a look at what's happened in the Northern Rockies is a great comparison. You know, they introduced wolves in 1995 into Yellowstone, a lot of fanfare, thousands and thousands of visitors, really pumping up the economy of local towns as a result of the wolves being back in the wild.
People going to visit to see wolves?
Well, if you spend any time in Yellowstone, especially in the winter, there are parts of Lamar Valley that are just walled in with people with cameras that have come from all over the world to photograph wolves in the wild. And yet what we see here is this constant fight from the livestock industry, Farm Bureau, livestock industry, NRA. The list goes on and on. Most recently and most disturbingly has been the efforts by the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and their new president, who used to be involved in NASCAR and a number of things, who is wildly anti-wolf and has actually been helping to pay through Rocky Mountain Elk funds for the extermination of wolves up there, and has actually called for the idea that grizzlies should also be shot.
And I think that's an important thing to note when you're talking about top predators like wolves in Yellowstone, is the ecological value as well as the economical value to places like Yellowstone, where now people come from around the world to get these photographs of these animals. When wolves were reintroduced into Yellowstone, there was none. There were zero wolves. Now there's over 100. And when the wolves came back, they noticed that the entire ecosystem changed. And what happened is that, you know, the moose had not been able to be in Yellowstone because they didn't have a food supply, because the elk were tramping down all of the willows that were near the riparian zones in the rivers. And when the wolves came back, it started making the elk more active. They had to start moving instead of lounging around the side of the river.
And that's what we had Mary Ellen Hannibal on the air the other day, and she talked about the ecology of fear. So when these animals are frightened, they move on. The plants grow better.
Absolutely.
And the rivers become healthier.
And birds return. You know, it's a magical transformation. It's something that, you know, is beginning to happen here in New Mexico. But how can it happen when there's only 58 wolves in the wild?
57.
Now there's 57. Yeah, exactly. There's only 57 because we captured one yesterday. And now we have a governor saying that capturing the one and putting it in isolation for the rest of its life is not good enough. She wants to see the whole pack removed. So, again, this is a very political battle. And what I like to talk a lot about is that we really are the silent majority. There are so many people in this state that want to see wolves in the wild. And yet we sit back and we allow the livestock industry to just push and push and push. And we have a game commission here in this state that could be doing a lot to help wolves in the wild. And we have a game commission that is nothing but corruption. And it's a commission that, you know, you have members that one day supported wolf reintroduction, and now today they're totally opposed to wolf reintroduction. We have commissioners that give big money to political candidates so that they can sit on a commission and absolutely do nothing but make our state a game farm. And I say a game farm, that means an elk farm. They're not thinking about predators. They're not thinking about wolves in the wild. And it's going to take a real rebellion from people in our state to make this. Because if we don't speak out, if we don't start hitting the governor very hard on this issue, if we don't start hitting people like Dr. Benjamin Tuggle, who's the head of U.S. Fish and Wildlife here in, based in Albuquerque, he's the Southwest Regional Director, then we're going to see the same thing happen here that's happened in the Northern Rockies. And that is really, we have gone from having 1,500 wolves in the Northern Rockies to them being decimated over the last few years. 500 killed in Idaho, you know, just ruthlessly trapped, snared, aerial killing. The means of which are not, you know, in Montana last year, one of the big debates was to allow spear hunting. I mean, this is how crazy it's gotten. Imagine people running around with spears, like, you know, I mean, it's hard to imagine, but this is the level to which people want to be able to go after wolves and go after predators. We're as an organization not opposed to hunting, but I think that what we kind of come to see at the end of the day is there is way too much in the way of trying to control wolves. And we thought we had a situation with the reintroduction in the Northern Rockies. I keep trying to use that as an example. Because what they did in the Northern Rockies was the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and so many people like Yellowstone National Park had this belief that if they really worked with the communities, if they really reached out to people and explained the biological importance of this, then people would come together and support wolf reintroduction. What they never understood was that the livestock industry and cattlemen were never, ever going to support this. And no matter how much evidence was put out there, no matter how much information or support they were given, and that included getting money when cows were killed.
Right.
They've done nothing but inflate the numbers. They've done nothing but distort the facts. And that's exactly what's occurring here in New Mexico. And you have people in the South like Congressman Steve Pierce, who has done everything he can to distort reality when it comes to wolf reintroduction. And what we're seeing here is no wolves have been released in over 4 years in New Mexico. And they're not ever directly released here. Remember, we only get the problem wolves. They're direct released in Arizona. When there's a problem with cattle, then they're shipped back to New Mexico.
And it's also important to note there is a wolf recovery plan intact for the state of New Mexico that the state has failed to meet. So they actually have a plan that they agreed upon to fulfill, and that includes making sure that the population of Mexican gray wolves does reach a number over 100. They have not even come close to that number. Like we said, there's only 57, and they continue to remove wolves from the wild. But there's all these wolves queued up and just waiting to be re-released, and they're not approving these releases.
Not only that, they look at things like starting to have conversations about, well, there's some older wolves in the wild. They're not that genetically important. Maybe we'll take them out, and then we'll put some new ones in. I mean, it's preposterous. First of all, we don't need to be thinking about limiting where wolves are. Wolves need to be released in far more parts of this state. They don't need to be limited to just the Gila country. There's great habitat in other places. We understand that they're going to bring good things. And people say, well, that's crazy. You know, how can you even think like that? How can I think like that? How can we have the persecution of this animal going on across the West in, you know, 2012? We understand their biological importance. We understand they're not attacking people. They're not attacking school children. There's no evidence of that. Never has been any evidence of it.
There's a mythology of it.
Of course, yes. There's a mythology. But that mythology is just like the mythology of the great cowboy. That's not reality either. And it's the great cowboy that continues to push this mythology. And that mythology is very damaging to our environment. Listen, nothing has more impact on the land long-term than livestock grazing in the West. It's been decimating to so much of the land and to the water. And when you have a situation like that and you have people that are in incredible positions of power on a state level, with the Game and Fish Department, let me just be clear. The Game and Fish Department answers to one group of people. It's the ranching industry. If they have a second group they listen to, it's the oil and gas industry. But there is a very direct tie, and there's a reason for it. And they are getting real results. When you see our governor applauding the capture of a wolf that evaded trappers for over 3 weeks, and then says it's not enough to take that wolf out of the wild, the whole pack has to come out. First of all, it flies against the will of the vast majority of people in this state. It's insulting, and it shows the deep level of corruption that is in power here when it comes to predators and recovery of wolves in New Mexico, and we see it across the West.
You know, I'd like to, we were talking about the mythology of wolves, and I've been working on wolf recovery since I was in college in the 80s, back in, when we were working on the Yellowstone Plan in Idaho, and also in Idaho. But, you know, the mythology of wolves is really interesting in that, you know, this myth has been created that the wolf is bad, big bad wolf. But what people don't know about wolves is that they live in families, just like people do. They have a social structure that is so complex and so endearing to watch that if you knew the level at what wolves, how they work together as a family unit and how they take care of their young together, how they grieve for the loss of members of their pack, how they mate
as
for
dogs
life.
Dogs do.
Yes.
Much like domestic dogs.
Much like domestic dogs. And that they're not just lone wolves out running around on the landscape, that they crave and yearn to have a family unit. They want to be accepted by their family at whatever level they are in that family unit. And that, you know, when a wolf is taken out of that pack, they literally sit and grieve. You can see them mourn the loss. We take a group to Yellowstone every year, the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. We take our members out there so we can look at the wolves. And this year when we went, we witnessed a young wolf. Her pack had left her and crossed the road, and she must have had a bad experience crossing the road, so she would not cross the road. She stayed on the other side. And they left her, and we watched her as her pack left, and she cried and cried and cried and howled until she lost her voice. We watched her trying to howl with no sound coming out of her voice. And one of the biologists we were with told us, you know, they always come back for her, but she'll stand there at the road and cry until they come back.
And did they come back?
And then we did confirm later that afternoon that they did come back and were reunited as a pack. So they knew she was there. They came back to get her. She was watching her emotional distress. It was so interesting to me. And I think if people really understood wolves and how they live together and how they love their pups and they raise the pups together and how they mate for life, that people would understand that they are the most intelligent, fascinating animals.
We're talking to Demise Foster and Steve Capra of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. And It's interesting. I had a conversation with somebody about food webs and the food chain. Basically, whether you're talking about a desert ecosystem or a coral reef or an Arctic Ocean or a forest, every ecosystem has top predators, top carnivores, and without them, the ecosystem becomes unhealthy.
It's no question, and we see it time and time again, and yet in every one of those ecosystems, it's the predators that always seem to be under the most attack. They're the most misunderstood. And I think it's because they're the animals that can instill fear in humans. They can see what occurs. But, you know, they play the most important role we see in a functioning ecosystem.
Now, the people who are trying to be advocates of elk who are against wolves... Mm-hmm. What's going on with that? Do they love elk because they're cute? Do they want to hunt elk?
No, it's about hunting elk, and I would say it's important to distinguish here. There's different sportsman groups. You have something like the New Mexico Wildlife Federation that totally supports predators being on the ground. They understand it's going to make elk healthier in the long run. In the short term, sometimes when wolves recover, there's a drop in elk because for the first time those elk are confronted with wolves. But like everything,
and they've gotten lazy.
And they've gotten lazy, and they get picked off. And but the it's a natural system, and that natural system we can look up in Yellowstone, and we were there last year, as Denise was pointing out, and which I have to say is an incredible trip. And when we were up there, we were talking to the biologist, and he was saying, you know, there's a lot of things that occurred here. First of all, this area used to be full of coyotes. And when the wolves came in, the coyotes pretty much were taken out.
Because they're the second level carnivore.
Right. So they fill the cracks between the wolf areas where the packs run. In those areas where there's just a little gap, that's where the coyotes come in. The elk had learned to migrate out of the park where they had just sat lazily in the park. And so now they've moved out of the park, and they spend a lot of time actually up on Ted Turner's ranch, which is north of the park. But the point of it is there's this migration that occurs. There's more elk now. The cycle has returned. And in Wyoming last year, they had to add an extra number of days to the elk season because there were too many elk. And they're having similar situations in Montana where there's been a great recovery of the elk. So to say that, but unfortunately, despite all that, you have somebody like the president of the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation who focuses on one thing. His focus is, I want all the elk that we can hunt all the time. And any predator that stands in the way is problematic, ignoring all the science about, you know, the dramatic overgrazing that occurred in Yellowstone and obviously in parts of Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, as a result of having these immense elk herds. So it doesn't, again, jive with science, but, you know, everybody has their sort of base that they work from.
I think there's another issue, too, which is that when you have wolves being the predators who are hunting elk, they're weeding out the weakest elk. When you have humans who are hunting elk, they're trying to get the biggest and strongest elk, which makes the elk herds worse off.
Well, not only elk herds, but that's what's occurring now with wolves, because there's a hunting season on wolves, and like anything, if you're somebody that wants to hunt, you're going to try to take out the biggest wolf you can find. And so now we're seeing real dislodging of some of the genetically strong wolves from the wild.
There's a philosophical issue underlying all of this, I think, and that is, what is nature for? Is it for beauty? Is it for our amusement? Is it for our sport? Or is it something much bigger?
I'd like to address that a bit. I think that what people need to understand is that nature provides us with clean air. It provides us with clean water. We're all connected to our ecosystem. And when an ecosystem is in a healthy state with the top predators in place, with that's completely in balance, and we're not extracting too much too fast, that it will continue to provide us as humans with the air and water that we need to survive and the food. Once you start going into ecosystems, I mean, look, there's hardly any wilderness left in the U.S. that's untrammeled. That's why groups like ours are trying to preserve the little islands that are left that have not been completely destroyed or impacted by man. And, you know, New Mexico had the first wilderness. The Gila is the first, it's the birthplace of wilderness. It's the first wilderness area ever enacted. Yet we're we're last in the West for protected lands, unbelievably. And when you think about the need for water in New Mexico and the shortage of water, you would think that people would understand we need to be good stewards of nature, because nature is what provides us with what we need to survive. So I like to bring that up because, you know, so many times environmentalists and conservationists are accused of wanting to protect land because it's some kind of a religious experience for us, and we need to protect it because we want it that way. Well, it provides a very important function for the entire human race and community. So I like to just remind people of that, and that, you know, if we can live in balance with our ecosystem, then we're going to benefit in the long term.
So what can our listeners right now who are listening and who are concerned about wolves, who are concerned about healthy ecosystems, who are concerned about what's happening in New Mexico, what can they do? How can they get involved on this particular issue?
Well, I think it's critical that their voice be heard. And I keep saying that, you know, we are the majority in this state. Poll after poll has shown the majority of people support wolves in the wild. But yet we have a situation where this small minority with a lot of special interest money is controlling the debate. We need people to be letting this governor know in no uncertain terms, wolves in the wild in New Mexico. We need Ben Tuggle. And I think people should look back a few weeks ago. The initial order on the wolf that was just captured was to kill it. We had so many people call Ben Tuggle that Fish and Wildlife Service stepped down, and they decided rather than kill, they would capture. Now, that's not the solution we really wanted, but I will take that solution as showing the power of people. And I think there's another really important element here, and that's our senators. Our senators have been neglect in moving conservation issues. There's a reason why we're last in the West in lands protected. There's a reason why there's really no debate on this wolf issue, because it's kind of a third rail they don't want to touch. And they need to understand loud and clear they need to touch it, and it's the will of the people. And if I could, I'd segue into national monuments, because this is a perfect example of that. The reason I say this is, you know, we've worked on national monument campaigns for 6 years in our state. We've worked on protecting Otero Mesa for over 10. All three of those, we have Rio Grande del Norte, we have the Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks, and we have Otero Mesa, three national monument proposals. Down in Doñana County, where the Oregon Mountains Desert Peak is, we've done polling that shows 83% of the people in our state support that national monument, 82% in Doñana County itself. Let me give you a perspective on that. There's no place in the United States that has polling that high. And I talk with national groups all the time. They can't believe it. There's no coalition that matches what we have in southern New Mexico to get this monument created. Yet, when I talk to Senator Bingaman's office, there's continued concern. When I've met numerous times with Interior Secretary Salazar, he goes, keep growing, keep giving me diversity. You don't have more diversity anywhere in this country than we have in the coalitions we have in
southern
New
Mexico. What does he mean by that, keep giving me more diversity?
What he means is he doesn't want to deal with it. And what he means is he's blowing me off.
But, I mean, what do those words mean?
Those means are, I guess he wants to get to 100%. And there's no way you ever get to 100%. And when I say diversity, you're not going to have a more diverse coalition than we have down there. The same goes for Rio Grande del Norte. 76% of the people support Rio Grande del Norte. A very diverse. We have land grants. We have acequias. We have as much diversity as you can imagine. Down in Doñana County, we have Hispano Chamber of Commerce. We have tribes. We have so many different groups that are involved in this. And yet, I talk to people in government who say to me, within the White House, there is no environmental thinking. Within the walls of the White House. And that's a tragedy. Not to say Mitt Romney would have any. But within this White House, they don't see the urgency to get landscapes protected. And what I'm talking about here is close to 1 million acres of land. When we include Otero Mesa, we're really talking about almost 2 million acres in New Mexico. That 2 million acres changes us from being last in protected land to moving us up the ladder a little bit. And we have a state that seems to really do well in being in the lower percentages, whether it's health care, education, whatever it might be. And we don't need to be last in protected land, and that's why we need to move, and we need to pressure these senators, not only on wolves, but on these lands, and say it's not good enough to sit there and say we're working on it. We've been working on it for 6 years. We're never going to have 83% support again. It's time for action.
We're talking to Steve Capra and Demise Foster of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. So you were talking before the break about Otero Mesa and Rio Grande del Norte. What are these areas like? Why are they important? Why should they have national monument status?
Well, I think one of the things that people don't realize is, let's take a look at all of our monuments. First of all, or our monument proposals, I should say, when you look at each of them, they are archaeological wonders. And that's something I think people don't even understand. When you look at a place like Otero Mesa, there's more archaeological sites out there than most of the West. Archaeologists think it's a gem. Petroglyphs, there's tens of thousands of petroglyphs. The discoveries, there's so many discoveries that haven't even been made. When you look at our area in Las Cruces, Doñana County, people are shocked when they find out that Geronimo hit out there, Billy the Kid hit out there, Apollo astronauts trained for their walk on the moon in parts of the area we're trying to protect. It's not just the land, and the lands themselves are magnificent. Same with Rio Grande del Norte. You've got this amazing river cutting through this beautiful landscape with the Ute Mountain. When you go over to Otero Mesa, you've also got this incredible history. Buffalo soldiers. This is where Buffalo soldiers were fighting Apache. This is the only area where the Texas Rangers were turned back in their history. And it was all over the battle over the Salt Wars. It's just incredible history that we want to hand down and for people to see. When I go back to Washington, I hear, well, the BLM doesn't like Otero Mesa because you guys fought them so hard on it. They don't want to deal with it. Well, I'm sorry. You know, you have a multiple, you have your responsibility is to protect and to develop areas. And
what was the BLM, what was the nature of that battle with the BLM?
Well, the nature of the battle was over oil and gas and our fight with HACO, Harvey E. Yates. And our job was to make sure oil and gas development didn't occur out there. Now, of course, we're dealing with mining threats. And at every step of the way, we've had to fight, and at every step of the way, we just keep building coalitions, and we keep trying to make not only this administration, but again, I go back to our senators. Our senators look at Otero Mesa, and they kind of go roll their eyes. I think they really understand Rio Grande del Norte. I think they really understand Doñana County, and they want to see them protected. But I think there's got to be that final push.
One of the things that's ironic is that there's so much water under Otero Mesa, and we're such a dry state, and you would think that that would be their first priority.
Well, again, you know, we've had a lot of conversations. Water seems to be something we always talk about as important, but then in reality, we treat it like trash often. We frack all over the state. We do a number of things that impact water. And, of course, our pacts with the Rio Grande River and the Pecos give most of our water away. And so the idea of respecting water, I think, is a slower thing for people to really get through. And you're right. Under Otero Mesa is one of the big reservoirs of our country, and we're squandering it.
One of the big reservoirs of our country. I mean, what are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about just millions and millions of gallons of fresh water. We estimated at one point enough to give a city of over 1 million people 100 years worth of water.
Oh, we're
talking about a significant amount of water, and yet we sit here and we talk about rare earth mineral development. There's still we're still battling an oil rig that may be put in by Harvey Yates. And so we have a number of battles, and what we're really battling, unfortunately, is a sort of level of ignorance, because people look at things like grasslands and they say, why a grassland? What's a grassland? Why is it important? And yet, from a biological standpoint, it's an incredibly important landscape. And there's nothing protected in our national park system called a grassland, really. Canada did protect a grassland as part of their national park system, but we don't have one in the United States.
And one of the big problems, unfortunately, again, people are so driven by kind of the myths and images as opposed to the scientific truths, which don't always have the same kind of resonance, but there aren't picturesque, beautiful, dramatic paintings of grasslands as there are of mountains and rivers.
Well, that's just it. And our vision in America long has been of sort of a Yosemite image of what a national park
exactly.
is or what a protected area is. It's beautiful mountains, snow-capped with a river cut through the heart of it. But as we've expanded our knowledge and understanding of nature, we've begun to understand that places like grasslands in many ways are far more biologically active.
What's going on in grasslands? Like, give us a kind of a description.
Well, I mean, you've got birds, you've got amphibians, you've got antelope.
In Otero Mesa, there is a species of pronghorn antelope that is only found in Otero Mesa.
Yeah. There is so much. Like, I have spent time out there, and sure, there are days you could go out there and see very little. But there have been days where I've seen hundreds and hundreds of pronghorn. I saw a mountain lion running across the grasslands. I have seen bobcat. We have seen deer. We have seen more hawks, eagles than you can imagine. You feel the life of the place. And I want to tell you, when you're standing in a sea of tall grass, if we have a good rainy year, we haven't had a lot of them in the last few years, but go out to Otero Mesa in October after a good rainy summer, and you will stand in waist-high grass, and you will feel the magic of that place because it comes to life. And there are mountains out there. They're not, you know, a number of them, but there are several mountains. And you're standing there looking, as you look to the east, and you can see the great mountain chains that cut through there, both to the north and to the east. And it's fantastic. And you sit there in that sense of solitude, that sense of space is something we just don't have enough of, and it's magical. And people come out there, watch a sunset where there's some clouds, or be there when there's a thunderstorm, and you will feel like you are sitting underneath a drum set because it is hitting you right over the head. It's magical.
So we have magic, we have many, many species, we have water, we have archaeology, we have history.
And yet we also have this stubborn resistance to do it. And you sit there and you say, why? With 83% support in Doñana County, with the whole community saying, not only do they want protection, they want 600,000 acres that surrounds their community protected. The senator put a bill forward that was about 250,000 acres. And now they sit there and they say, 600,000 acres? Really? And we say, yeah. That's what the community wants. And we've done our work. See, our job as an environmentalist isn't always to come on the radio and scream and complain. It's to organize.
Yeah.
It's to be on the ground, and it's to get people educated on why something like this is important. And 6 years later, you look at a community that says 83% of the people want this, and they want it now. What are we waiting for? As Senator Bingaman himself said to me, I don't see polls anymore where 80% of the people support anything.
Then isn't that Steve Pierce's district?
It is. And that's
why are they electing him?
Well, that's Las Cruces. That's not eastern New Mexico. And eastern New Mexico is a different animal, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he has his pockets of support. And Las Cruces has really got a progressive government. And a progressive mayor, and they've done a great job of moving this forward. And as I say, the people in the community have really responded. You know, the Oregon Mountains are one of the great treasures in our state, just from a visual standpoint. Then you take the other areas, and the sportsmen really want to see these areas protected. And again, who's fighting us? Small group of ranchers in the community. A small group of ranchers, I might add, that, and again, I know it sounds like I'm totally opposed to ranching. I'm not. We have ranchers we work with that are terrific. It's more the type of rancher we're seeing down there, fanatically anti-wolf. They had a parade on the 4th of July in Las Cruces, and this group of ranchers, in unison with the Tea Party, flew the Confederate flag and enraged the community. And so those are the people that are fighting us, and there's no reason that people like that should be winning this debate.
And mining.
Well, in the mining, you know the mining story. It's this, you know, group out of Cameroon that speculates in mining, that really doesn't have a proven track record, that is basically saying all of southern New Mexico is rare earth minerals, but they interestingly targeted Otero Mesa to stake their claims, coincidentally probably knowing that there's a big push for a national monument and looking for a buyout. And so, you know, that's reality on the ground. We're going to continue to fight it, and that's why we keep asking our senators and we keep asking the president, get us a monument. And it's important to say, we're never going to get Steve Pearce to work with us on legislation. Oh, he put a monument proposal forward on the in Doña Ana County, and it was for about 1/10 of what we're asking for. And he did that as a smokescreen.
Right.
But he has told us bitterly, I will never support any legislation. So the only way we're going to get these areas protected in southern New Mexico is the president's use of the Antiquities Act. He is going to have to do it.
And the Antiquities Act allows the president of the United States to establish national monuments?
Yes, and circumvent Congress. And so that's how we defeat him. And I actually think in the long run, if you get a few monuments created in Steve Pearce's district, then he might be willing to come to the table and negotiate. Because right now he feels empowered to stop everything.
Now, Jeff Bingaman, Senator Jeff Bingaman, is on his way out, and there is, at this point, what seems like a reasonable likelihood that Martin Heinrich will become the next senator from New Mexico if polls turn out to be true. What's his position? Have you been speaking with him?
I think Martin Heinrich will be very supportive of our conservation goals, and I think he's worked very hard to support those conservation goals. In the past, Heather Wilson has worked to protect the Valles Calderas, but she's shown no willingness to support us on these other ventures at all.
We're talking to Steve Capra and Demise Foster of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. So you also have work going on that involves Chaco Canyon. What's happening there?
Well, we've been working for a number of years with Senator Bingaman's office on getting Chaco Canyon protected as wilderness, with the idea that there has been so much oil and gas development on the periphery of the park, and there continues to be a lot of pressure. And in fact, several years ago, the state land office had to actually pull some areas that would have allowed rigs within viewing distance of the park headquarters.
And good heavens,
yeah,
the visitor center.
Yeah. And one of the things the BLM likes to do a lot is say, well, we'll put camo on rigs, and then you won't really see them. And so we go
through. That sounds like a joke.
Well, it's just this endless thirst for oil. And, you know, you have something like Chaco Canyon, which is just this amazing part of our heritage. And, you know, we've long felt the park needed to be expanded, number one, but we also feel like wilderness will also give the park another tool in fighting the BLM. They can then say to the BLM, you know, this is designated wilderness, and you can't just be putting these rigs on our periphery. The BLM listens to things like wilderness. They don't necessarily listen to things like World Heritage Site. That doesn't really have much meaning for the agency. But what means something to them is wilderness and respecting those boundaries. And we've had great support from the park, the superintendent of Chaco. She's been tremendous in helping us. We've been reaching out to the archaeological community. We've had some success. And our effort here is that, look, this area is too important to risk. You can't have seismic activity going on the periphery of the park and shattering potential, you know, housing that's been there since the 11th century. You know, we've got to have real action to protect this park. And I think a lot of people in the Santa Fe area look at Chaco as a jewel. And I think they understand.
Yeah, who hasn't been there?
Yeah, who hasn't been there? Who doesn't look at it and say, wow, this is magical. And so, you know, in our thinking, let's give it the strongest protection. And interestingly enough, there's been a wilderness proposal floating around for Chaco since the early 80s. And I think it's something that's been on the National Park Service list. National Park Service wilderness is always sort of the thing that they look at last because they say, well, it's already protected. Why do this? But you do it because you don't want, well, I'll give you a couple of examples with Chaco that I think are really important. There's been a huge push in recent years to build a road all the way into the park. If you build a road all the way into the park, suddenly you're going to have a bunch of RVs coming into the park, which haven't traditionally been coming in because of the rough road. If a bunch of RVs start coming into the park, well, then the park might be inclined to say, let's build a restaurant. Oh, let's build a store, you know, with food. And let's build a hotel. Let's get a cell phone tower in. And before you know it, that incredible experience you have of Chaco has been completely transformed. And so by creating wilderness there, we sort of take that ability away and we say we want to maintain your experience in this park long term. So there's sort of the two goals. We want to limit oil and gas development on the periphery of this park. And I should say, you know, there's a long history of trying to get at coal around this park. So you never know when that could come back into play. And so you want some baseline protection there, and you want to maintain the experience that people have when they come in the park. And our goal ultimately is, let's look and see how we can expand that park, because it's a treasure.
I think one of the things that we also have to think about as a community, and the community involves every single person in the state of New Mexico, and by extension, the country, and indeed everybody living on planet Earth who uses electricity and who drives cars and all these things, is that whatever you take out of the ground doesn't get renewed. Every single thing you take out of the ground, it's a one-way street. It's never going in again. I mean, until we have how many millions of years did it take for dinosaurs to turn into oil?
Right.
It was a long time. It was beyond any kind of human civilization scale. So that doesn't count. So basically, we have to really think not later but now about how we're going to get the energy to live the kind of lives that we want to have. And I trust that everybody listening to this show does not want to sit in the dark all day playing the ukulele for amusement and, you know, planting their own vegetables, and that's their life. We want to have this kind of lovely life that we have. And I think one of the dangers of gas mining is that we put off the question of how we're going to get our energy for another sort of 30 to 70 years.
Right. Well, that gets us back to the conversation of a Manhattan Project, because, you know, what we're doing here is delaying the inevitable. We're allowing the oil and gas industry to continue to maximize profits. We're all paying for it at the pump. But we're not just paying for it at the pump. It's what you said. Things are coming out of the ground that aren't going back. We're destroying potential water resources and setting the stage for the wars of the future. And we are allowing, I mean, we hear Republicans all the time screaming that this green energy is a farce. Well, it hasn't paid off like we'd all like, and I think we all feel a certain sense of frustration. I think we all thought, geez, we can move to green energy and everything's going to be great in 5 years, and it's not that way. It's a long-term thing. But until we get, you know, our labs like Los Alamos fully focused on things like this, until we get our country saying, look, this is going to be a major investment. We made huge investments in nuclear power, and it didn't pan out. Okay, that's reality. I was looking at The Economist the other day, and they had a headline, The Death of the Nuclear Power Industry. Okay, I don't think that's the future of green energy. I think there's too much evidence that shows us we don't have the risks we have with nuclear power. We have the potential upside that comes from it. We just have to really spend some money and some mind on it. And I don't know if that's going to come all from the private sector, or that's going to have to be something the government makes a serious investment in.
Or both.
Or we can start with things like stop subsidizing oil and gas. Take the money you're using to subsidize oil and gas right now and put it into innovation.
And one of the things, as we've talked about, there's a wonderful physicist at Los Alamos who is working on energy storage and what are the ways of the future not only to do energy storage, but to incentivize energy storage. So that's a conversation that will be ongoing on this program.
It's very important, and I think also getting away from the myths that are out there. We see all these TV ads. I mean, every day, I watch the news. The news is sponsored by one group these days. It's the oil and gas industry. I don't know if you've noticed, but they're trying to educate our kids now in school. They want better math and science kids. They want to do all these things, and oh, what a job they've done in the Gulf cleaning up the mess. This is mythology,
right?
Okay? It's expensive.
Greenwashing.
It's greenwashing. Yes. That, you know, I was reading the other day, the same advertising firm that is doing all these commercials was the same advertising firm that worked for tobacco for so many years.
Right.
You know, their hands are dirty. They continue to exploit this stuff on the street, and people believe it.
And they do the best they can, and eventually they lose.
They do. The question is, how much collateral damage?
Right.
How much collateral damage are we willing to accept? And again, it gets back to speaking out. It gets back to letting your voice be heard.
And one of the places you can do that is at the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Ladies and gentlemen, nmwild.org. You can call them. You can email them. You can take action on their website. You can get involved in so many different ways. And one of the lovely and beautiful ways that everybody can get involved is by going to the Lenzic Performing Arts Center on October 23rd. What's happening there?
On October 23rd, we are very lucky to have the internationally famous classical pianist Alain Grimaud coming to New Mexico for the very first time. She has agreed to do a solo performance at the Lenzic that will be a benefit for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance and her organization, the Wolf Conservation Center, based out of New York.
Now, October 23rd is a Tuesday.
It's a Tuesday. The concert begins at 7 p.m., and what's really important to note is that tickets are very affordable to this benefit concert. You will get a chance to hear a world-class classical musician who also, coincidentally, is passionate about wolves. She is a big wolf advocate. She has her own center in New York, a place where wolves, they have had Mexican gray wolves that actually have been released here in the Southwest. And she's coming to help us raise awareness for Mexican gray wolf recovery here in the Southwest to help protect and restore our wolves here.
And she's not only a wolf advocate herself, she is a crazily fantastic, amazing player. Like, if you've heard her play.
I've heard her play. I've heard her play in New York. And, you know, they call her the rebel of classical music, of pianists. She's quite young. She's in her 40s. She's been playing music her entire life. And when you watch her perform, it is a very emotional experience. I had never experienced classical music like I did the night I watched her perform. She is playing from her album Resonances. She's playing the entire album.
What's on it?
What's on it? Well, there's Mozart. There's a large collection of different classical sonatas that you can hear every single piece from beginning to end. And so classical music fans have just been getting in touch with me like crazy. They're very excited that she's never come to New Mexico. She usually only travels in Europe and New York. And here she is coming to New Mexico for the very first time, and she's so looking forward to it. This is a great chance to see her play a solo performance. She'll play for an hour at the Lenzic next Tuesday. She's also going to be a part of a couple of other events that we're doing over 2 days. You can get a VIP package and actually meet her in person. So she has really made herself available to us to connect with our Santa Fe community.
Let me just add a couple of things. She's, first of all, beautiful. Second of all, people need to understand she's flying from Switzerland to come and play this concert. That's incredible. She's only played at Carnegie Hall and in Los Angeles. So we're getting something that people, it's just hard to imagine. And to put her in perspective, she is still so excited about one thing when she gets here, and that's getting in a small plane and flying over the Gila with the hope of seeing some wolves in the wild. I mean, she's very down to earth, and she's this incredible talent. This is a very unique thing, and we really hope people will come out and support it.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being on the air. Steve Capra, who is Executive Director of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Demise Foster, who is the Santa Fe Director of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Thank you for being on the Radio Cafe, and once again, nmwild.org.
Thank you.
Thanks.